Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, January 14th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, thanking the nurses, clinical technicians, and the entire staff at Saratoga Hospital for the care and support they provide. Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med, saratogahospital.org. Joining us today is Dr. Iftikhar Saeed of Ellis Medicine, a general surgeon. He's here to discuss a range of procedures, including those for diverticulitis, gallbladder disease, acid reflux, colon cancer, and breast cancer. It's going to be a busy hour, and I guarantee you that. So be sure to get your calls in early, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. See you then. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Iftikhar Saeed of Ellis Medicine joins us today for Medical Monday. A general surgeon, he's here to discuss a range of procedures, including those for diverticulitis, gallbladder disease, acid reflux, colon cancer, and breast cancer. I have raised all of those with you because many of you have had some of those diseases. Dr. Saeed earned a number of degrees from schools in Pakistan before completing a residency at Yale University Hospital, as well as an internship at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany. He's certified by the American Board of Surgery and joined Ellis Hospital in 1979. Dr. Saeed, welcome to Medical Monday.
You're welcome, sir.
Glad you're here. The number to call, everybody, is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so, Doc, let me start you out by asking you this question, and that is, I see on the things that you do, is one of the operations you do is for acid reflux. Now, many people have been taking medicine that they should have been taking for a few months, for 1,000 years, in order to keep the acid reflux down. What exactly do you do?
Okay. Basically, the acid reflux is a medical disease that you have millions and millions of Americans who have reflux. They become a surgical disease, and before this, when they come to see me, they have already been on medication for a long period of time. And either they cannot take medicine anymore, or the reflux is not, medications are not working, or they have a complication of the medications. So what I do surgically is creating an artificial sphincter at the lower end of the esophagus.
So the sphincter is at the lower end of the esophagus?
Yes.
Okay.
So we have a natural sphincter, every one of us. And we all have a reflux, which is very transitory reflux. As we swallow our saliva, the reflux, the acid is neutralized. In many patients, the acid is not neutralized because they have incompetent lower esophageal sphincter, or they have a hiatus hernia, which is a portion of the stomach above the diaphragm, and that, with every breath we take, creates a negative pressure and sucks the acid and non-acid into the esophagus. So we are creating an artificial sphincter to prevent the acid to go up. Basically, you take a left side of the fundus of the stomach, you bring behind the esophagus to the right of the esophagus, and what we call plication, you suture to the surface of the esophagus. So there are two kinds of the artificial sphincter we create. One is the complete sphincter, and other one is a partial sphincter. With a complete sphincter, the esophagus is the stomach is wrapped around the esophagus in a 360 degrees, like a complete. In a partial, it is 270 degrees or slightly less or more. Each one has a benefit, each one has a drawbacks. The benefit of complete Nissen fundoplication or artificial sphincter is that you have a between 90 to 95% benefit of no reflux. Mm-hmm. But it also creates more difficulty in swallowing, and you are unable to belch, and you are unable to vomit. With the partial sphincter, that you are able to vomit, you are able to belch, and your acid control is 85 to 95%. In my practice, I did about 750 of these complete Nissen fundoplication in the first 10, 15 years. And at the present time, in the past 10 years, I have only done partial. I do not do complete Nissens anymore with the same benefit.
I got it. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, 1-800-348-2551. Doctor, I wanted to ask you about diverticulitis. Now, it's my understanding as a layman, probably wrong, that the diverticular is a pouch that occurs in the duodenum.
No, it could be in the duodenum, but that really does not require much surgery. It is in the colon.
Colon, yes.
Yes.
And then what happens is a seed or something small can get into that pouch and can create a certain amount of hell. Is that right?
Yeah. The biggest basic mechanism is that you get an inflammation around a seed or foreign material or even a food which dries up and stays there in the diverticulum for a long period of time. And then you get an inflammation, and inflammation causes the reaction around the colon we call diverticulitis. So that's the mechanism of diverticulitis.
So what's the difference between diverticulitis and diverticulosis?
Diverticulosis, that you have a outpouching of the intestines. Diverticulitis is when you get the inflammation, we call it diverticulitis.
So all the people who have osis are, in fact, have the pouch. And the itis is when something gets in the pouch.
You could get the food or material in the pouch, but doesn't mean that you're going to get a diverticulitis.
Right.
It's like an appendicitis that we have an appendix when we are born. But not everybody get appendicitis.
Okay, so very quickly, because the phones are loading up already, 1-800-348-2551, talk to me about appendicitis. I have an identical twin brother. When we were seniors in high school, he was facing a Spanish regents, I remember that. And we all thought he might be putting on the dog a little bit, but he came in and claimed that he... So off to the hospital he went, and he had an appendicitis. And they took the appendix out. How come it happens in some people but not others?
Well, if I have the answer, I'll be a very rich person. So unfortunately, we don't. There are a number of factors that we do. It is the commonest in children between 7 years and 17 years. Then the incidence kind of decreases and then increases again after age 50. So we don't really know the mechanism. Usually we think it starts with inflammation, increase the swelling of the lymphatic tissue of the appendix, and then it causes the appendicitis. Or you could have it just like diverticulitis. There is a called appendolith, a little dried up stool in the appendix, and that caused the obstruction and you have an appendicitis.
Right.
Very rarely that you could get a cancer of the appendix and could present like a appendicitis. Extremely rarely you have a called mucocele, where the opening of the appendix in the colon is blocked and the appendix is filled with the mucus material and become a little sausage. So that's the reason for appendicitis.
Have we ever? I know that over the years people have tried to paint the appendix as something other than, it's almost a verb at this stage of the game, or an appendix is useless. But do we know why it was there in the first place?
Well, we don't know, but God created it, so it has to some purpose. We just don't know.
At some point it was there.
At some point it was there. And I think literature says that there might be a part of the immune system, that we have a more less untoward effect when you have in your normal appendix. But
So we don't, doctor, have any evidence that people who've had their appendix out, following up on this very interesting thing you just said, we have no idea that people who had their appendix out have different outcomes in terms of their health than people who have them in?
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, we'll take some calls. Let's see. I tell you what. We won't take some calls. We'll just go to a break, and then we'll have a long time on the other side of just a few second break. Go ahead, Zachary. And we are here back, and your questions, the lines are loading up. And we'll go to Suzanne in Warwick. All right, Suzanne in Warwick, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Okay. My daughter is 21 years old. She, when she was about 8, started getting bad reflux problems. She would be playing outside, and she would just throw up and then go on playing. She was sent home from school a lot. They did endoscopy. They determined that the doctor said she was very, very corroded in there. They put her on medication. And then it subsided after maybe 2 years. And then she started getting sick again when she was maybe about 18. And on and off, she's had more endoscopy. She's had sonographs. She's had every test in the world.
Okay, Suzanne, I don't want to cut you off, but you have to ask the question. What's the question?
Okay. The question is, so she gets diarrhea a lot, she throws up a lot, she's had billions of tests, I don't know what's wrong. The question is there such a thing as an emotional stomach, something that your emotions just make you sick easily?
Well, there's possibility, but I think what you described to me is mostly her reflux, which is not under control, even with the medication. So even though she has endoscopies in the past, what she really needs are called pH studies and motility studies. That's a special test done by gastroenterologist. So let's assume that they say that she has a reflux with this lower end of the sphincter is not controlling the reflux. Then she will, after so many years of treatment, she will be a good candidate for making an artificial sphincter, which is called Nissen fundoplication. So she really needs to be seen by a gastroenterologist and have a proper workup.
Well, Suzanne, I'm assuming she's been smart enough to see a gastroenterologist.
She's been to many, 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 many
doctors. Okay, well, that's
over
great.
And over.
You heard the
what
answer.
What about diarrhea?
Well, diarrhea is probably not a part of the esophageal reflux disease. It could be a side effect of if she's taking the medication, could be the side effect of the medication.
Okay, thank you, Suzanne. 1-800-348-2551. We've got a Meg who is on the 90 somewhere. Meg, your turn.
Hello, doctors.
Yes, ma'am.
I had bariatric surgery in September of 2015, and I've been on Prilosec daily for that since to help protect the stitches and to control my acid reflux. That artificial sphincter that you are speaking of, I also had a hiatal hernia that they repaired with mesh. I know to the minute if I happen to miss my dose of Prilosec. Is this like something that I can consider to possibly go off Prilosec? Because I know long term you're not supposed to be on generic name is omeprazole because of joint issues. But
did you have a sleeve gastrectomy or you had actually gastric bypass?
I had a vertical gastric sleeve.
But once you have a sleeve, then if you did not have a reflux before, you are more liable to get a reflux.
No, I didn't realize how bad I had it before. It was just something I lived with. I didn't understand.
Yes. So with a sleeve gastrectomy, you are not a candidate for having an artificial sphincter. You may be a candidate for a new procedure called Lynx procedure, where they put a magnetic, it's a bead in a circle. It's not approved yet, but you could be a candidate for that.
Yeah.
Can you repeat the name of the procedure,
called
please?
Lynx, LINXY.
And when you, Meg, okay. when you had the surgery, the bariatric surgery, did the situation get any better?
Weight, yes. Reflux, no.
Yes, right. But if you have a sleeve gastrectomy, then it will not get better. If you had a gastric bypass, then that is one of the also procedure for reflux and obesity.
Okay, thank you, Meg. All right, 1-800, now we got a real chance to get in. If you want to get in, now's the time to do it. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And checking in a little later than usual is Jim from Matamoros. Jim, what do you got?
What type of closure materials are currently used for intestinal anastomosis?
We actually use these days staple anastomosis, which is a titanium and stainless steel coated with titanium staples.
And what is the situation that Jim is referring to that I have never heard of?
Well, he's referring to if you remove a portion of the intestine or colon or stomach. Sure. How do you put them back together?
Yes.
So in old-fashioned days, it was done by hand.
Yes.
Which was the suture we used to use.
Right.
In two layers.
Interesting.
The inner layer was the absorbing layer. The outer layer was the silk, which was permanent. So these days, we purely use staple lines. So it's a stainless steel staples.
And do you do that robotically?
We do that robotically too, yes.
Uh-huh. So,
what's that chronic gut you used to use, or plain gut?
Plain gut, and yes, or cat gut, which is actually a sheep gut, not a cat gut anymore.
Wow.
And the silk. But these days, it's purely a staple anastomosis.
Thank you very much, Jim, from Matamoros. And now we'll go to Florence in Kingston. Florence, you're on.
Hi. I had colorectal resectioning about 5 years ago, and I have not had a colonoscopy since, and I'm concerned that if I did so, because I lost 16 inches of colon due to diverticulitis, that the colonoscopy wouldn't go so well. How would they see how I've been rerouted?
Well, the way the surgery is done with the diverticulitis, if you lost about 16 inches, they still put you together. So they should have no reason or difficulty in doing a colonoscopy or seeing the things they need to see. So I will strongly advise that you have your colonoscopy.
I didn't have any polyps. I never have.
Doesn't matter. How old are you, ma'am?
65. And what about Cologuard? That new test where you don't have to have the colonoscopy.
At the present time, the gold standard is the colonoscopy.
Yeah. In other words, you have to drink. You have to drink the stuff. Like it.
You got to drink. I'm not afraid of drinking this stuff.
No. I think like the gold standard to look at the colon.
Yeah.
Is colonoscopy.
Now I know somebody. I was telling the doctor about this, who had a removal of part of his colon. Decided he didn't have to do anything again and now has real, real, real trouble. So I would second, being a PhD in political science, but I would second the doctor's idea that, you should do it.
Do you have a problem with the new Cologuard test?
I don't have a problem with the new Cologuard test, but if you are asking my opinion, what is the best way to look in your colon, then it will be a colonoscopy.
Just do it. Okay, so Doc, what is the Cologuard test?
Well, it's a stool test.
Yeah, I see. So,
and then if it is theoretically the principle behind it, if you have a
bleed.
Tumor cells, then you will be able to diagnose.
But they've always been able to do that to look.
But that was they called blood. That was for blood. For Cologuard is little more than blood.
Well, is there any good reason for people not to do that?
I think, again, it may come to the point in the future where we are too much advanced, where we can pick up the things.
Yeah.
But at the present time, I still think this colonoscopy is the best.
No. I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah. I just want to make sure because, obviously, some people get colonoscopy once every 5 years. Some people get it once every 10 years. But in the meantime, why not do this other thing?
Well, you could do that. It will be helpful. But let's assume that you had your colonoscopy at age 50, which was your first colonoscopy.
Right.
And if they really didn't find any polyp or any
Indeed.
Other disease, then
right.
chances are in the next 5 years, you're not going to have any problem.
That's that wicked saying, the chances are.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So why not? Okay. Well, anyway, that's a good answer, I'm sure. Now we're going to go
to, I suppose, we'll go to Teresa in the beautiful Catskill Mountains. Teresa, you're on.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi there, how are you doing? It's interesting that my call is coming right after the person that you just spoke with. I am calling because I have diverticulitis, and it's quite severe. I have just received in the last 2 days my Cologuard test that I will be taking, and the next step will be going for a colonoscopy, which I really don't want to do, but I probably will have to go for. My question is, do you have any suggestion in general for the diverticulitis problem for foods to really avoid? I have very severe burning sensation on the left side of my abdomen or stomach area.
How many attacks you have so far?
You mean of the burning sensation?
No, how many, you say you have a severe diverticulitis. Usually that means that you had a inflammation and a pain that you were diagnosed with a CT scan. So how many episodes that you had?
Well, actually, I have not had it since about 30 years ago. I had it about 30 years ago and was taken care of by the same doctor that I see. And then about several months ago, I had started to have it again.
Okay, so I think the best approach will be to have a colonoscopy first. And if the if the gastroenterologist says that, yes, you have a diverticulosis or diverticulitis, but it's getting better, that usually I recommend that you stay away from the seeds like a corn, any popcorns and peanuts and or anything with the skin. You can eat apple but no skin. You can eat potatoes but no skin. Because as a human being, we do not have enzyme to digest skin part of the fruits. So they are the one goes down.
So no skin.
No skin, but you could eat the fruits and you could eat the vegetables.
Well, good luck to you.
What about fried? I'm sorry, what about fried foods?
Fried food has no adverse situation on diverticulosis.
Except if you're on my diet.
So that's okay.
Thank you, Teresa. And the telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. We'll go now to Donna in Woodstock, and she is on line number 3. Donna, you're on.
Hello. Well, I have two little questions, but just from what about really, really cooked skin? Like if you boiled the hell out of something and it had skins on it.
But still the skin particles are not digestible.
Oh, even with digestive enzymes?
Yeah, we don't have our own enzyme to digest the skin part of the fruits and vegetables.
And yet...
Oh, okay. Well, and yet you get those enzymes in pills. But here's my question. How close is the vagus nerve to the esophagus, and how close is the appendix to the ileocecal valve?
Okay. The vagus nerve is actually embedded in the wall of the esophagus.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. Somehow I suspected.
And the
and
appendix
what about
is
the appendix and
from ileocecal valve is about 3 to 4 centimeters.
3 to 4 centimeters?
What?
Yes. 3 to 4 centimeters.
Which is like 4 inches?
No, it will be less than
eight
an
inches?
Inch. No, less than an inch.
Oh, I mix up the centimeters and the inches.
Yep.
I have
yes.
to get that straight. So 3 or 4 centimeters, you
yes.
said. All right. I mean, I have stories, obviously, but...
You know, Donna, we're not ready for the stories right now, but we are ready
to follow
it up. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, and now we're going to go all the way up to the top of the list to Doug from Del Mar, who's been hanging on for a long time. Okay, Doug from Del Mar, you're on.
Okay, hi, doctors. My question was, when you go for a colonoscopy, they fill you up with this gas, and does that do anything for the does it cause diverticulitis if you have a tendency towards that?
These days, they are actually putting carbon dioxide instead of air, so the side effects are very minimal. It is the same carbon dioxide we breathe out when we take a normal breathing. The very rarely, if you have a diverticulosis, which is very thin wall, that you could perforate it, but that also can happen any other part of the colon.
Now, this business about using not using the air. What difference does that make? Because those of us who've had it quite frequently think of, you know, that we're going to be flatulent, to put it mildly.
Yeah, the air is a little difficult to get absorbed into the circulation. The carbon dioxide is very rapidly absorbed, so it has minimal side effects.
So you're not feeling the same urge to...
You are right. Yeah. You actually, within 10, 15 minutes of your procedure, the carbon dioxide is literally absorbed in your system.
Okay, back to you, Doug. What do you got?
Okay, is there anything new on the virtual colonoscopy? I mean, I did Cologuard. That was great, but I'm looking down the road, too.
Virtual colonoscopy, the problem is that they need to take so many pictures. For a radiologist to sit and read all those pictures, it's quite time-consuming.
When what?
When you do the virtual colonoscopy.
The virtual.
Yeah.
Because when that came on the scene, I think Doug knows this, it got a real good send-off, but it's been a little bit of a disappointment?
Just because of the time involved.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when the thing's going down. Doug, anything else real quickly?
No, thank you so much.
Thanks, bye. Okay, let's go now to, Linda in Ulster Park. Linda in Ulster Park, you're on.
Hello, doctors. Thank you for taking my call. I was just recently diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus.
Sure.
And I've been taking the omeprazole every day. But I wonder what the prognosis is. Is it something that can be cured, or is this a permanent condition?
No, the Barrett esophagus, again, is a medical disease, and it can be cured with the medication, or if it is severe enough that they could call endoscopic excision or Botox injections. So extremely rarely we operate on people with a Barrett esophagus.
But it is precancerous, right?
If it is there for a long period of time, yes, it is a precancerous.
It can be, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Well, thank you, Linda. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. And now over to, Suzanne in Westfield, Massachusetts. Suzanne.
Hi, yes. I'm not sure if you've answered the question already with the virtual colonoscopy, but there's a pill that... a camera that's in like a pill form that you can swallow instead of going through the regular colonoscopy. How effective is that?
Well, that's called capsule endoscopy, and that's rarely done, usually done to find the pathology in the small intestines. So not for the colon.
To find polyps?
Yeah, it is for
the... polyps?
Yeah, no, you swallow the capsule, and then you pass in the bowel movement, you retrieve it, and then you give it to your gastroenterologist. But it's not as suitable for colonoscopy. It is suitable for small bowel because we can't reach the small bowel from the top or the bottom.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah. When it came on the scene, it had a lot of hype also.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
So again, it's a very time-consuming for a gastroenterologist to review every picture.
Right, right. Suzanne, anything else on that?
No substitute for a regular colonoscopy.
Yeah, everybody keeps looking for a way not to drink the stuff. Okay, thank you, Suzanne. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Right, bye. Okay, and now over to Martha in Boyceville. Martha in Boyceville, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing?
Good, thank you.
My husband was diagnosed with left-side colitis through a very routine colonoscopy. And the doctor keeps saying, you know, it's very mild, except he feels terrible. So we did some research and first put him on a low-fiber diet, and that was a very bad diet for him. And now we have him on a diet with no carbohydrates and no sugar, and he's feeling better. But do you have any idea about how to deal with this?
Well, it depends what kind of colitis he has.
They're saying left side colitis.
No, left side is only anatomical name because it's on the left side. So whether it's a ischemic colitis or whether it's a ulcerative colitis or whether it's a Crohn's colitis or whether it's a...
They say it's not Crohn's, and he didn't say if it was ulcerative or ischemic.
So then it could be non-specific colitis. So that usually will get better without even any treatment.
Okay. Huh. All right, so... And he eats a good diet normally, never eats a lot of, doesn't eat bread or pasta or any of those things. And, oh, boy, it's just been a 4 months of hell because he always feels like he has to be near the bathroom.
Then he needs to be followed by his gastroenterologist, so they may want to re-scope him to be sure that it's resolving or not resolving.
Okay, Martha, thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Okay. We're going to take a very short break now. There are two people on the phone, so if you want to get in for the last round, the lightning round, as Ray Graff always says, then call in now, 1-800-348-2551. All right, we are back. We just got handed an email from Ava Marie, who wanted to say, my father and sister have both had their gallbladders removed. My father had no symptoms until his emergency room visit that led to its removal and the discovery it was gangrenous. My first question is, should there have been signs that we missed for it to have become badly decomposed? My second question is, does that elevate the likelihood that I will need mine removed as well, or things I should look out for? Thank you. And that's from AD. Okay, what do you got?
I'm going to answer the second part first. It is unlikely that you will have the same situation as your father had. Uh-huh. Usually on older people, depending on their age, in their mid-80s or early 90s, they may not have symptoms, and they may think that they have an indigestion or a kind of intestinal flu for 2-3 days before they come to the emergency room. To gallbladder to become gangrenous, you have to be sick for at least 3 to 4 days in your old age.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Otherwise, it's inflammation, acute cholecystitis, but gangrene is usually that you are sick for 3 to 4 days.
Okay, so that's it on this. Thank you very much, Doctor. Okay, now we're going to go, as promised, to the person who's hanging on the longest, who happens to be not a guy, but Judith in Saugerties. Judith, you're on.
Hi. Yeah. I just wanted to say that I control my acid reflux very well, actually, by sleeping on my left side when I have an acid reflux situation. And taking ginger, either ginger tea or I use crystallized ginger. And if it's serious and I sleep on my left side, I generally wake up feeling fine and spend the day that way. And ginger helps if it's like midday or something like that. I have crystallized ginger, which is absolutely delicious.
Okay, Judith, hold on right there. Doctor, do you want to respond to that?
I think that what you're describing to me, you're doing fairly well. You do not need a surgery, and you do not need other medications.
Okay, thank you, Judith. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And now we're going to go to Bob in Rhinebeck, who's been patiently waiting. Bob in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Thank you. Doctor, you mentioned CAT scan for just to see the scope of the diverticulitis. Where does barium enema fit into it prior to surgery? I've had multiple bouts over the last year and a half, like every 2.5 months. So we got to do something. But I'd like to know what the scope of it is in the system.
Well, barium enema used to be the test, almost 30 years ago.
Everybody had.
So, but now, once the CAT scan is available, and especially the modern CAT scan, you get much more information from CAT scan than pure barium enema. Barium enema will only tell you what is inside your colon.
And that is used in combination, doctor, with a regular x-ray, right?
Also, but you could do a called barium enema CAT scan.
I see.
So you could have a contrast from below. and have a CAT scan, and you will get better information.
Okay. Well, thank you.
This is very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay. And now we're going to go to Michael in Richmond, Massachusetts. Michael, go.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, so typically I get heartburn reflux only at work when I'm bending over, getting back up. I just don't know if that's a common thing or...
Yeah, every one of us have a heartburn like that, and that's usually not a serious illness.
Women sometimes get it during pregnancy because
there's
a lot of pressure put on to them.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, okay, yeah, because I don't typically get it unless I'm at work, you know, bending over, getting up.
Okay, so don't bend over. Thank you, Michael. All right, let's now go to Mike, another Mike. Mike in Pittsfield. Okay, Mike, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes. I have a question to ask the doctor.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm 84 years old. About 8 years ago, I had the scope done. I was wondering if I need to have it done again.
I think you need to talk with your primary care and gastroenterologist. Usually these days they are not doing a colonoscopy after age 80 unless there is some really medical reason.
And what's the reason for that?
Well, I think they think that after age 80 that the benefit and the drawback outweighs the benefit.
And the drawback is that your tissue is a lot
you're
thinner.
You're right. You could have a complication. You could have a perforation, which can create an emergency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike, thank you. Okay, let's now go to, whoever's there. We can't do that because they don't see the name yet. Well, I'll try it anyway. Who's on line number five? Line number five, who are you?
Hi, my name is Pamela.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm a stage 4 colon cancer patient. I've been 2 years without evidence of disease. And I was intrigued by what you were talking about, the pill that you swallow for the small intestine, because I've been scoped on the top and scoped on the bottom, but I don't see anywhere where they check in your small intestine, and it's my understanding that CT scans don't see through the tissue into the small intestine. Is there concern that we're not looking at the small intestine, or does it not normally come back?
The colon cancer will not come into the small intestine unless there is some reason for us to look at it. Usually in your situation, either the PET scan or a CAT scan is the test of choice.
How often do you recommend PET scans?
Well, that will be up to your the oncologist. You know, how often they are seeing you, what is your blood test for CEA level, which is a blood test we follow for the tumor markers. And if they are normal and your last PET scan and CAT scan was normal, then, you know, you are in very good hands and continue the follow-up.
Now, thank you very much for that call. Appreciate it. Doctor, one of the things that scares the hell out of me and everybody else is pancreatic cancer. And we don't really have a very good test for that. And so usually by the time we know it's there, it's too late.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Unfortunately, as you said, that you're right, the pancreatic cancer is a very serious disease.
Right.
The 5-year survival is only 5% throughout the nation.
Right.
And by the time you diagnose, it's not all the time that it's not resectable.
Justice Ginsburg.
I use the rule of 50s. So the 50% of the time the patient I see the first time they are not candidate for surgery. Another 50%, I think they are candidate for surgery, but when I do the surgery, they are much advanced disease than we thought. And the 50% which are left, which is really 12.5%, are surgical candidate. Unfortunately, the treatment for pancreatic cancer is only a surgical treatment to cure. So you could have a palliative treatment, you know, radiation, chemotherapy.
Yeah.
But to cure a pancreatic cancer, you need surgery.
But sooner or later, certainly, they're going to have to figure out some way, in the same way they do a colonoscopy or all these other diagnostic things, that we're going to figure out who has pancreatic cancer.
Ultimately, I think will be that everybody will end up having a CAT scan on every five-year basis.
Well, will the CAT scan, if I had a CAT scan today, would they tell me if there's any early pancreatic cancer?
Early cancer may not be picked up, but by the time it is 2 or 3 centimeters, definitely we are going to see on a CAT scan.
And is that enough so that you could say, if we do early surgery, we could conquer this disease?
The only cure is the early surgery on pancreatic cancer.
No, that's right. Okay, here we go. Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll go to Cindy in Schoharie. And by the way, everybody, keep your questions short because we're running out of time. Go ahead, Cindy, you're up.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about appendicitis treatments. I understand in Scandinavian countries, they tend to not remove the appendix unless it's close to bursting, and they use antibiotics. Is there a reason this protocol isn't used in the U.S.?
Yeah, the trend is kind of going forward, but in my personal opinion, you end up with a much more complication with the antibiotics and waiting. Half of those people ultimately in 4 to 6 will end up having an appendicitis, even with the antibiotics.
In 4 to 6 years?
4 to 5 weeks.
Oh, weeks?
Yes.
Okay.
The standard of care today in America is appendectomy once you are diagnosed with appendicitis.
Cindy, thank you. All right, and now we're going to go. I'm trying to get everybody in here. We're going to go to Tom in Mayfield. Tom in Mayfield, you're on.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Bring it. 43-year-old male. I was diagnosed with acid reflux when I was 20. Did all kinds of tests, a restrictive diet, like taking everything away, slowly adding things back. The only thing that worked, that has worked, is medications, Nexium, Prilosec, Meprazole kind of stuff. Recently, there's been research that that I was reading that showed some cancers, stomach cancer, bladder cancer, and kidney failure. Was curious what your opinion on the medications are and what else could be done.
Well, Tom, we don't have an hour, but very quickly, your concern is that of a lot of people. In the beginning, we were all told, and I've been on it for years and years, that if the that this was a possibility. Doctor?
You know, any medication has a side effect.
Well, cancer is quite a side effect.
Well, if you're, you know, if you're taking it for a number of years, then there is a possibility, but not a proven fact that they do cause high incidence of cancer.
And is that's because the hydrochloric acid or whatever in the stomach is not there anymore or is cut down?
The incidence of stomach cancer is higher on people who don't take the anti-acid medication.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Okay, well, Tom, you can sleep easy. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Right, bye. And now we're going to go to Mark in New York. All right, Mark in New York, let's go. Trying to keep up.
Hi. So, can hypothyroidism cause severe acid reflux and pains in the stomach?
You said hypothyroidism?
Hyper.
Not that I know of any relation with the reflux.
And how about hypo?
Same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Mark, thank you very much. All right. We're going to try to make it here, but everybody has to cooperate. Let's go to Katrina. Katrina in Tivoli, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to hear the doctor's opinions on fecal transplants for chronic GI infections. I can hang up, too.
No, don't hang up.
Okay. So the fecal transplant is only for the C. diff colitis. Usually we treat them with antibiotics. Called vancomycin suspension or flagyl. And if people keep on getting repeat infections, then the fecal transplant is the suitable treatment.
So Katrina, which is the one you think you have that might work with?
I don't have either, but I just I was curious about them because it's something that I don't know a lot about them, but I've heard about. And I was just curious at the success rate of the fecal transplants in curing those infections.
The answer, doctor?
It's only in a specific C. diff colitis treatment.
Okay. And does it work?
It does work.
Okay. Thank you, Katrina. All right. Now we're going to go to Sarah and Troy. All right, Sarah, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had a quick question. My husband had a colonoscopy, his first. He's 50. He had, like, a couple of polyps that were nothing, but he has a precancerous one that seems to be on the edge of the appendix and on the colon. So he's referred us to a surgeon and says the best course of treatment would be to get an appendectomy. And I wonder if you can give me any other detail around that, since it's on the edge of the colon and the appendix.
Okay, so actually it's not for an appendectomy. It is for appendectomy and removing a portion of the cecum called cecectomy. That's the only way he's going to remove the part, the appendix and part of the colon where the tumor is creeping out of the appendiceal opening into the colon.
And what's a cecum?
It's a cecum is the portion where appendix is attached.
I see. Okay.
That colon, part of the colon we call cecum.
What's up, Sarah? Any more?
So, just so I'm clear, I'm hearing impaired, so I'm having a little trouble with the phone. So you said they wouldn't be taking the appendix?
They will be taking the appendix out and also another 2 centimeters of the cecum, part of the colon.
Oh. That's what I thought, too.
Yes.
Any advice or thoughts around the healing of that?
Well, it will be just like an appendectomy. You do that with the laparoscope and you fire a staple line where you need to take part of the cecum out, and usually it is an outpatient surgery, and you are followed by
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Have you ever done one of those, Doc?
I've done a lot.
A lot of them. Okay, yeah. Sarah, I got to go. All right, now, last caller for the day will be Dave in Pittsfield. Dave, you got 1 minute with question and answer. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a hiatal hernia and have been taking ranitidine for the acid reflux for years, and it doesn't seem to be as effective, certainly not as effective as I'd like. Any other suggestions on other drugs to take?
If you have a hiatal hernia, depending how big it is, then the only treatment will be fixing the hiatal hernia and doing a reflux procedure. And that's why your control is much less, because you have a hiatal hernia along with the reflux.
So you mean surgery?
You are right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's 4 centimeters.
Well, 4 centimeters is not a big hiatal hernia, but that's contributing into your reflux symptoms.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. All right. So we're done. I can't believe it. We got through. We got every single person who was on the phone. I'm patting myself out on the back. We're just about out of time. I want to thank all of you who called in. Apologize to all of you who I may have seemed rude to, but I was trying to get everybody in. I'd also like to thank Dr. Iftikhar Saeed of Ellis Medicine for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz, who keeps me honest. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.